We have, after this colloquium, two more before the Christmas and New Year's period. Next week, we have Jim Gates from the University of Maryland talking about supersymmetry and some beautiful mathematical and mathematical relations related to them. And then we have Martin, and this is an approximation, Hanhoff, an astrophysicist from Cambridge. And then we will start again in mid-January. And again, if people have suggestions or ideas for Sophia, please tell Lucy and Hardy, who is taking over as of then. And we definitely need it. If you've never done it, you may not appreciate how hard it is to keep a good Sophia program going and getting good, high-quality science speakers week after week after week. So that relies on people's suggestions, so please send your suggestions to Lucien. So having said that, it's a great pleasure and honor to have Stefan Alexander here. Stefan has been here many times before, but not for a few years, which give you a hard time about, not for about 3.5 years. Stefan is a very exciting cosmologist on the boundary between quantum gravity, string theory, particle physics, and cosmology. He did his PhD at Brown, and then he went to Imperial College, and then Stanford, and then Penn State, where he was a faculty member, and he recently moved to be a faculty member at Haverford. We're very, very happy to have him here. He's talking today, and also at 11 o'clock on Friday at the Cosmology School meeting. And his title is Einstein Left Hand.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be back. I'm going to embarrass Lee, but I remember when I was a postdoc. There, he was on sabbatical, and then a few weeks later, I witnessed you and Rob Meyer and a couple of other people devising and talking about the birth of the Primit Institute. That was back in 2000, so it was exciting to see what it's become over all those years, over the last 9 years or so, and it's a great honor to be here. So the title of my talk, without further ado, let me get my hockey stick here. I'm from the Bronx, and we have golf sticks in the Bronx, actually. So anyway, the title of my talk was Einstein Left Hand. Actually, the original title was What's a Right Hand? But then I realized that my collaborator, Nico Yunez at Princeton, he used that title already. So I'm using the other half of the title. So what's that with holes thing, like a gun?
Do you have to grab any Canadians here?
The upper end. Yeah, that way. Yeah.
Okay, good. So the basic, my talk is going to be more of a phenomenological talk. It's going to be motivated from phenomenology. And what's my philosophy in phenomenology? My philosophy in phenomenology is to say, what have we tested in gravity experimentally? What do we know about gravity in the solar system, especially in the solar system, experimentally? And what haven't we tested? And then can we come up with some effective theory that encodes that? And then can we constrain that effective theory? And then we go back and ask a theory of what types of theories may accommodate such an effective term. And how unique is that effective term compared to, with regards to the various theories? So I'm coming from a very agnostic point of view. I don't believe that one theory is any more fundamental than another theory. I'm going to try to develop observations that will actually pinpoint, real physical observations, that will pinpoint these effects. And so the goal of today is to look for parity violation in general relativity. Now, let me a few remarks about parity violation. Parity violation is only something that's well-defined in odd dimensions, odd spatial dimensions. When we talk about four-dimensional Lorentz invariance physics, if a particle is massless, the variant of parity violation is chirality violation. Okay? So basically, the alignment of the spin with the momentum of a particle. Like a neutrino in the massless limit has a chirality, is a good quantum number. So it's an eigenvalue of the momentum eigenstate of the neutrino, for example. All right. So what I'm going to talk about here are massless things, in this case, gravity waves. Okay. And the title of my talk is really about, does gravity have a preferred handedness? And can we look for this effect in the sky, in the solar system, and binary systems? And I'm going to, the goal of this colloquium is to report on recent work done in the community and by various people on this effect. And so let's begin. So is Einstein left-handed? Well, here's a picture of him smoking his pipe with his left hand. Or is he right-handed? Here's a picture of him writing with his right hand.
But his gifts can be flipped.
That's a good point, and I have no proof of that. It's too late to ask Einstein the question. Or is he ambidextrous? So a lot of the forces in nature, in fact, it's well known that all but one force in nature is parity invariant, meaning invariant under inverting the handedness of a coordinate system. Okay? And for example, let's look at good old-fashioned electromagnetism. Here is the action of electromagnetism, E squared plus the electric field squared plus the magnetic field squared. And parity will basically invert the parity operator. Since the magnetic field is a pseudo-vector, it takes B to minus B. And however, because B is squared here, and it takes E goes to E, this whole term is left invariant under an inversion of the coordinates. Okay? So basically, a circularly polarized light will remain circularly polarized under reflection. And Max will tell you, obviously, because this term is identically zero in vacuum, all right, for Maxwell's theory. All right, the Poynting vector, E cross B, is non-vanishing. So the electric field and the magnetic field, that's a statement, they're mutually perpendicular. All right, so the cosine theta here just vanishes in vacuum. Okay? And this also holds for QCD. Quantum chromodynamics is also parity invariant. However, the electric weak force is by construction, again, by observations. The electric weak theory is parity violating, but then it's by construction because you take out the right-handed component of the vector, the right-handed component of the vector potential. Okay. Now there are so-called left-right models of the standard model that includes both chiralities of the gauge field, of the electric weak gauge field, and those theories are also parity invariant. But observations tell us, okay, that electric weak maximally violates parity. So it's the only force that's been observed to violate parity. And I want to ask the question now, have we tested gravity for parity violation? But first, let's look at the theory of general relativity. The theory of general relativity has our good old-fashioned friend, the Einstein-Hilbert term. And we can include stress energy from whatever you want to put in the standard model, Lagrangian. And we can ask, well, you know, because R comes with two derivatives of the gravitational field, G, this term actually is invariant under parity. And of course, what I'm going to talk about today is Einstein's theory in vacuum. I know some of you are very clever and you're probably already thinking, well, we know that theories of torsion, for example, can violate parity. What I'm talking about here is good old standard Einstein-Hilbert gravity in the second order formalism, okay, in vacuum. So I'm not going to talk about matter that sources parity violation. I'm talking about in vacuum here. So let's try to now construct minimal terms. Let's try to construct additional terms in higher orders of R, starting from the lowest order, that will actually transform. Actually violent parity. So we can, one thing that to note is that the Lebesgue-Civita tensor is proportional to gamma 5. And so if I have the Levitch Vita tensor multiplying a Riemann curvature tensor, that term would actually violate power law. I'm sorry, let's first start with an epsilon. By the way, just a point of mention here. There's going to be lots of contractions of lots of tensors. And I want to convey the physical content of my talk here. So my convention for contraction is dots and dots. And let me be more specific here. I'm actually going to go a little bit further. For example, if you see a term, this term here, how many people can see this? So we have this interesting contraction of the Levitch Vita with a Riemann curvature tensor, with two Riemann curvature tensors. By this convention, I'm talking about a Levitch Vita tensor contracting with two Riemanns. Okay? So I just want to not deal with confusing you further with contractions. If you want to delve into contraction, you can go look at my physics report with Nico Ignaz that was just published a month ago. And I forgot to put it up here. Okay. So let's go back. So this term, if I contract the Ricci tensor with a Levitch Vita, this term actually vanishes because of the symmetries of the Ricci. What about this term? This term vanishes because of Bianchi identities. These three last indices are anti-symmetric, and this is anti-symmetric, that term vanishes. So then we have to get a little bit more complicated. So the next lead-in term that you can add to the Einstein-Hilbert that encodes private violation is exactly the contraction of two Riemanns with an epsilon tensor. And this was this was discovered way back by Isham, Duff, and Besser back in the late 70s, and Salam. We actually computed something called a gravitational anomaly. Okay? And this is what I now call, adding this term to the Einstein-Hilbert action, I'll show you very soon how it actually violates power at lead and all. So I want to now state some important theoretical facts about this term. Now we have it. First fact, it's motivated by the standard model. It turns out that the hypercharged sector of the standard model, U1 B minus L, actually does have an anomaly meaning dot B. That global quantum number, okay, associated with the current conservation of the leptons, okay, so the neutrinos in the standard model, receives a correction from gravitons. And it's in volume 2 of Weinberg, page 198, something like that. I taught this class, Standard Model, last year, and you know I know this book inside, pretty much inside out. Now, that term actually, that term is necessary to cancel. Just like all the other anomalies in the Standard Model from the gauge sector, this term is there as well. All right? The reason why it's canceled is because the Standard Model is chiral. But for example, if I have minim, they're usually left-handed fermions in the standard model. However, if I introduce a right-handed lepton, like a right-hand neutrino, this term survives in the effective action. Okay? So the standard model is there. You can't chase it away. String theory, there's something called the first superstring revolution, where Green and Schwartz, in the type 1 and heterotic theory, were able to actually cancel a gauge anomaly against an anti-symmetric free form that lives on the world sheet. Okay, so you cancel a one-loop effect with a tree effect, and that leads to an extra term in the effective four-dimensional heterotic type 1 chiral supergravity theory, and that term is called the Green-Schwartz anomaly canceling term. And it's exactly the turn Simon's term. Okay? So there's some scalar field and all are dual. Okay, so that term is there, it's necessary. You need it there to cancel the anomaly in string theory. The problem there is that term is highly suppressed by a volume factor in string theory. So it's very hard to observe that effect. But it's there. And you can imagine cooking up interesting corners of moduli space, interesting exotic compactifications where that term could actually be enhanced. Okay? So it's there in string theory. And loop quantum gravity, recent work on, Lee had talked about this a long time ago. I kind of followed up on it. And then recent work by Alejandro Perez are now looking at theta sectors in loop quantum gravity where this gravitational anomaly term is there. Okay? So there are three different ways in which you can actually see how this term arises from some effective quantum gravity framework. But the goal of my talk is not to talk theory. It's to say, okay, this is kind of motivated by something theoretical. But what I want to do is look at the observational effects of this and see whether or not we've tested and then, you know, real live experiments that are on the way and, you know, actually in the sky today. So let's begin. So the roadmap of my talk, am I going too fast, by the way? Here's, I'm going to just, you know, quickly go over this effective theory by talking about the action, field equations. I'm going to skip the string realization because of time. And then I'm going to talk about some work that I did with Michael Peskin when I was a postdoc, and Mohammed Sheikh Javari, on how you can get leptogenesis very easily in terms of inflationary observables. Okay? And then I'm going to move from the early universe, or inflation, to the solar system today. And I'll talk about binary pulsars. I will talk about PPM, the PPM framework. And I will talk about the rotation of gyroscopes outside of the Earth. Because Chern-Simons gravity leads to a unique prediction, unlike any effective theory of general relativity. I won't get into that. But the basic point is for the experts in the room is that Chern-Simons gravity gives a unique PPM parameter that was never tested before. All right, and Cliff Will got very excited about this when we showed him this result. And it's this unique PPM parameter that's the reason why the guys at Princeton are so excited about this. The guys that do this kind of work. Okay. So let's talk about the action here. The action, first of all, the important thing here is the so-called Pontryagin density, which is the Riemann times its dual. Just like F, the electromagnetic field strength, times its dual, which swaps the electric field with the magnetic field. So similar things happen. Actually, the Sitter space has a very nice property in terms of its dual. Rob, I see you shaking your head. The simple action I'm going to talk about is Einstein-Hilbert plus this Pontryagin density times either a fixed externally prescribed parameter or a parameter or a dynamical field. Now, this one people usually call the non-dynamical framework, and this one people call the dynamical framework. And the reason why is because of history. Romain Jacquive motivated this action from a completely different perspective. And it has to do with embedding the three-dimensional Chern-Simons term into a four-dimensional space-time. So there's a nice paper by Jacquive and Pai where they motivated this action from a completely different perspective that I didn't talk about here. All right. And in that case, they didn't constrain any parameters for theta. So theta can be some dynamical scale field, and it's very naive, simple-looking action, has very nice features. And so what I'm going to talk about now are those nice features. So the first thing is that the field equation, the Einstein field equations, get modified. The important thing here is that the strong energy condition, or the divergence free of the vanishing of divergence of the stress energy tensor, gets modified. And you need to include this thing called the so-called Cotton tensor, which in its glory, is this term here. When you vary the Einstein-Hilbert action, you get these two terms. You get the Einstein tensor plus this Cotton tensor, which is this, and then whatever stress energy that you have due to the scale of field. All right? And this is only, you can only satisfy the strong energy condition when you include this Cotton tensor. So the non-dynamical framework theta is some background fixed field with no potential. So you naturally have that this term is purely topological, and it doesn't add any dynamics to the propagation of a gravitational wave. However, when this field is dynamical, you have that this topological term becomes proportional to the to this field, and then there's back reaction when you include gravitational perturbations. And in cosmology, for example, we have to take very seriously the perturbations. So that's how we get to CMB.
So right, sorry, can you go back?
Yes.
So beta evolution preserved SDP, what is this?
Strong equivalence principle. Okay. The divergence of stress energy density. Over and divergence. So I'm going to skip this. All right. So now I'm going to talk about now part two of my talk, which is how transcendence naturally accommodates leptogenesis. Now, I'm not going to spend my, this is an hour talk, okay, in and of itself. But what I'm not going to do is talk about, you know, Sphalerman transitions and whether or not they have strongly first order or not. And, you know, so what I want to do is to say that we have many models of leptogenesis out there. I just happen to think that this is the best. Why do I think it's the best? Not because I played a role in it. Okay? Not to be megalomaniac. Or anything like that. But actually because it actually leads to a prediction for CMB polarization. And I like models of leptogenesis that actually has predictions. And that there are guys who are like Ryan Keenan, who was recently here, who actually are building experiments and they're actively looking for these signatures. Okay? Or the plant people. They're actually looking for these signatures. And I kind of like that. Even though the theory is likely wrong, you know, all of you graduate students who are, you know, if you're going to become my graduate student, that's Calvin's theory. Okay? Oh, you go back. I was staring in the wrong direction. All right, so what is the statement? Well, the story is a very important story. If you look at the ratio of the light elements in all healthy spiral galaxies, they have the same ratio. And you can only get that ratio when you do thermonuclear fusion. Okay? There's something called a Saha equation, and it depends on a number to get those reaction rates. And that's a number. That is the difference between baryons and antibaryons divided by the photon number density. And that number is any different, you would not have nucleosynthesis, period. All right? Now, I didn't believe it, so I went to Bob Wagner, all right, who was one of the, and I said, Bob, how true is this? Because he wrote the paper, him and, who was the other guy? Started with an S.
Fred Hoyle.
Fred Hoyle. And he said it's absolutely true. You better bet your bottom dollars. With a New Jersey accent. So this is a very important number. Because it's not that we don't see anti-galaxies, right, in the universe, right? It's that we see this number. It's a number. It's not that we have antimatter, less antimatter than matter. But it's actually how do you explain this number in terms of fundamental physics? And the static model does not have enough CP violation, for example, to do it on its own. Okay? So you have to do something beyond the standard model, for example, to do it. Now, what I want to talk about is what are the necessary conditions so that you have a theory of baryon asymmetry in the universe. All right, so first of all, this is in the context of an expanded universe. In 1967, Sakharov, who was a great Russian physicist, you know, I was corrected. I gave the story. I gave a talk at Marcel Grossman, and Grashik was in the room. And I said, well, Sakharov was in a home prison when he did this to make my story exciting. And he goes, hey, what's correct? You're a great Russian physicist. So I knew Sakharov. He wasn't in a prison. Apologize. Don't put me in prison. Okay, so I don't know whether or not he was in a prison. It's an exciting story if he wasn't in a prison. It makes it even better. He basically said the following. The universe, if you imagine a process, okay, an unknown process, where you have a vacuum, for example, and, well, the vacuum of the standard model classically and quantum mechanically conserves baryon number. Okay, so So we have to imagine that there's something beyond a standard model. Its vacuum needs to violate or create baryons, okay? And at the same time, you better create more baryons over anti-baryons, so you simultaneously need to violate, okay, charge, okay? And also CP if you're talking about, depending on what, if you're talking about baryons versus leptons. Okay, but you better do that out of thermal equilibrium, because if you're in equilibrium, all right, CPT is conserved, and so if you violate CP and baryon, right, that is equivalent to its time reversal, so the system is in equilibrium with antimatter again, and it washes out whatever net baryons have been created. So it needs to happen out of equilibrium. So what Sakharov said, imagine the universe is expanding very rapidly, and I'm producing this, then I can actually, if the rate of expansion is much greater, for example, than the rate of the particle production out of the of baryons over anti-baryons, okay, then I'm done. So you just got to come up with a nice model, and then Savas, Demopoulos, and Susskind, and I believe in the 70s, and then some other people, of course, Sakharov, and a lot of people play this game, and they realize that actually the electron weak theory has these non-perturbative Strahlerron transitions that violate baryons. Okay, baryon number. And then they say, oh, well, imagine that the universe is expanding very rapidly, and I can cook up first-order phase transition and do the job. I'm not going to talk about that now. I'm going to talk about a way in which all this happens in one shot. Okay? And it happens because of inflation. So that's what I'm talking about. After I get it. But the effective theory I need to do this is Kern-Simons forever. If I don't have this term here, everything I'm saying is BS. And this is why it happens. What is going to do the job here are going to be the ripples of space-time. I'm in vacuum, but space-time is rippling. It's a gravity wave that I'm producing during inflation. We expect that to happen during inflation for generic inflationary models. And I'm saying, well, let's imagine it. Now, in vacuum, gravity waves, okay, that are produced satisfy the box operator. It's my favorite equation, right, the wave operator, right? So you have box on H, if I have a circular polarized gravity wave, is equal to zero, left. Box of H right is equal to zero, again, in vacuum. So during inflation, this is what happens, and you know, this beautiful stuff like quantum squeezing, the gravity waves get amplified, all this really cool stuff happens, and then you get a nice prediction of a B-mode polarization for gravity waves, curl-type polarization that we expect to live for in Planck. But here's the problem. It plays no physical role. See, the scalar perturbations actually play a physical role, right? They source the T-arm density perturbation, temperature density polarization, which corresponds to large-scale structure. But these gravity waves, they're just in this inert thing that we're going to go look for, but they have no physical role. The name of the game in this thing is to give the gravity waves a physical role. But unlike ordinary Einstein-Hilbert, because of the presence of this Kern-Simons term, when I actually include a gravitational perturbation, this term is non-vanishing. I get a source of back reaction of the gravity waves themselves onto the left-hand side. What does that mean? Question, sir.
Maybe it's sorry. Are you taking the theta to be dynamical?
Thank you very much. The theta here will be the phase of the inflaton field. The inflaton field in the most minimal inflaton models, okay, where we actually have the tensor to scalar ratio, that ratio is only non-degenerate when that's a single field inflationary model. And so the most minimal inflation model you can have is a complex scalar field. And this the complex phase, all right, we normally ignore it, but actually, because of quantum squeezing during inflation, the phase information is still there in inflation. It's actually necessary. So I'm going to keep this phase information, and I'll show you how it sneaks up. All right, that's a great question. Okay. But, you know, great question is great too, so. All right. Is anybody with me so far? The basic point is that the equation for a gravity wave simplifies beautifully, you know, when you do all the math, to the following. A left circularly polarized gravitational wave, one of these guys, is that left for you? It does this, right? I have a distribution of matter, the gravity wave passes through it, it's left vertical, and it rotates in this direction. A right circular polarized gravity wave does this. If the theory is parity invariant, left goes to right. However, in this theory, if I look at the right, the source of the left-handed gravity wave, there's a minus sign here. This is proportional to the phase of the inflaton field, okay? And the derivative of the gravity wave, okay? Whereas this term, the right-handed, has the opposite sign. And notice that there's an I here. So it actually changes the amplitude of the gravity wave, not the phase velocity. Very important. These gravity waves still travel at the speed of light, because I don't change the dispersion by changing the phase velocity. I change the amplitude. What does this mean? During inflation, the inflaton field remains constant. Its velocity remains constant. That's the so-called slow growth parameter. So all during the course of inflation, I am sourcing gravity waves, okay? Left-handed, circularly polarized gravity waves. Right-handed, circularly polarized gravity waves. But the amplitude grows in one and dies in the other one. So that when I take left to right, left doesn't go into right anymore. That is the source of the parity violation. So what, you might ask? So what, inflation has this nice thing where I produce one gravity wave over the other gravity wave, and over 6e-fold, the other one just exponentially dies off. In fact, the solution to this, with Michael Peskin and Shigeru, we found exact solutions of these gravity waves and the full bang-on power spectra in the at super horizon scales for inflation. And you might want to look at those papers. It was a source of great joy for me for my 3 years there. You know, a very humbling thing when someone can calculate like 50 times faster than me. Okay. Well, you get 20 times faster, but Michael's 50. All right, so here's how the shot gets. So here's my point here. The question I want to ask is, due to inflation, can primordial gravitational waves have a physical use? Well, I have reason to ask this question, because if I perturb the metric, of FRW metric, and I make it do the good stuff for me for inflation, we know it corresponds to the density perturbations that we observe in logical structure. But the point is that I'm going to make gravity waves play the role of generating the asymmetry. But I need one more ingredient. So the first ingredient I gave you was that the onset of this inflaton field, okay, the phase in the inflaton field sources the CP violation. That, in turn, carries itself over to the sourcing of gravitational waves of left over right, and the CP violation shows up now in the gravity waves. And then the gravity waves have to do, so I have CP violation. Now inflation is highly out of equilibrium. So I have rapid exponential expansion, which is out of equilibrium, production of gravity waves that are CP violated, and now I have to get lepton violation. Okay, so this is just a basic picture of how inflation solves the horizon problem and all that stuff. We've all seen that. But let me now. So the basic point now is that I can get all three Sakharov conditions with one shot, which is the initial condition for inflation. I have the inflaton field, it sources gravity waves that biases the amplitude left versus right. I didn't show any solutions, but that's going to take too much time. But at the same time, the rapid expansion due to inflation, these gravity waves are existing, propagating way out of equilibrium. Now the question is, how do we get the left-hand number production? And the basic picture that I want you to keep in mind is that you have a cup of coffee, and you stir a cup of coffee around, all right, and if you're going to bias the production of gravity waves in one-handedness, stirring is the inflaton field, and I'm going to now squeeze out, in a sense. Stir leptons out of the empty vacuum, and that happens precisely because of the gravitational chiral anomaly. It is well known that this is another current. There's a U1 near the current of the of due to the chiral symmetry, under chiral phase redefinitions of the fermion field, a global current, and quantum effects, one-loop quantum effects, actually tell us that d mu, j mu is all our dual. But all our dual is actually generated because of inflation. So if I calculate this guy here, I can actually read off the lepton number over the history of inflation. And that was actually the goal of our, in our paper. We did that calculation, full band and quantum field theory calculation, very exciting stuff. I learned a lot. And basically, that picture of the stern is exactly the stern, left-hand gravity wave, and the right-hand gravity wave, they interact with a fermion loop, and then you spit out leptons. Okay? And it's a one-loop exact effect, even for gravity. And if you're going to calculate this thing, and I won't go into the whole details, but I want to talk about other stuff, all right? You end up getting this expression, and it really organizes itself in a beautiful way. All right, so this vacuum expectation value that we compute during inflation is gotten from the following thing. We can compute that because RR dual comes in with bilinears of the graviton propagator and derivatives. All right, now we're going to, and so once we have that, we know how to compute the gravitational wave power spectrum due to inflation. Okay? So we have all of this nice machinery for us, and so you just do it. And if you do the calculation, we find a very interesting result that the number density, this is nothing more than dn and dt, is proportional to RR dual. You integrate this over the whole inflationary history, so you get the number density is equal to this integral. And the number density is proportional to the gravity wave power spectrum, which is something that we will observe, or hopefully. The amount of CP violation theta, okay, and how long the inflation lasts. And then there's some momentum dependence. You've got to worry about renormalizability and all this good stuff. I don't want to get into technical details. We'll talk after the talk. The point is, if we do phenomenology, we plug in the observables that we know from inflation. So for example, we know that upper scale, high scale inflation gives 10 to the minus 4 from recent WMAP data for this part here. We don't want to go into the deep Planckian regime, so we assume that at most the gravitons propagate at momentum that is 10 to the 12 GeV. All right, close to the scale of the right-hand neutrino mass. Okay, so we use a very safe number there. In fact, it works for even smaller numbers, 10 to the 3 GeV works. Okay? So we plug in that momentum. And then, this depends on the slow roll parameter of inflation. All right? So if we expect to see gravity waves, we know that we can get that from R, from the scale of the tensor ratio. That's roughly 0.3. You plug in these numbers, and you get exactly from inflationary observables. All right? So the point is that we can get the baryon number of density just from inflationary observables. That's what's cool about this. And if you plug those numbers in, you do get 10 to the minus 10 for this range of parameters. All right, and notice the important thing is that this cutoff scale, if even if I'm 10 to the 14 GeV, okay, which is where I could trust the effective field theory of gravity a la Donahue. And if I use the upper scale inflation, even if inflation is tighter, a very low scale inflation, I still get 10 to the minus 10. Does that mean that I've proven baryogenesis? No.
What is mu?
Mu is the momentum cutoff scale that integral.
Momentum cutoff. Okay.
The gravitons are propagating at some momentum, going around the loop and producing
fermions. Does it have to do with the start of inflation or what?
It does. It better be lower than the scale of inflation. That's an important point. And you have the same problem for inflation. Any gravity wave is doing inflation. Now, the important thing is the observables. So here's what's really cool. In upcoming and actually recent experiments, not only do we measure cross correlations of the temperature or the scale part of the power spectrum, okay, the CLs, meaning that for every, if I Fourier decompose, or in the spherical harmonics especially, the temperature field, okay, I get an ALM, okay, I get a Z angle momentum of this thing, and a Y element. Now if I look at that field at a different point, I can look at correlations of those two guys. And that's a cross-correlation between the two ALMs, okay, at different Ls and different Ms. And that is our CLMs. That's the vertical axis that we measure and we identify with the temperature cross-correlation. But these things come in vector quantities as well. Okay, because of the two-sphere, you can also decompose these modes in terms of vector spherical harmonics. And that comes in two forms, gradient and curves. And there's a proof in two dimensions that this is all you have. So what I call G and T, G and C correspond to electric type polarization, like the electric field and point charge, and magnetic type, curl type patterns. So here's what's really cool. So I can create these moments, and then I can get all sorts of cross correlations, and these are the so-called brightness functions. And what's really cool is that there are these ones here are purely parity R. Okay, because L is R, and parity goes as minus 1 to the L. If I now look at the cross correlation between temperature, okay, and curl, and this was done by Stolen, Cantaldi, and Jerome Giegio, you get the following interesting signal, predicted signal. So if H left is different from H right, parameterized by some parameter they call, what did you guys call that parameter? The chirality parameter.
Inversive parameter?
Yeah, but you call it the chirality parameter.
I don't remember what
it was. But anyway, the point being is that H left, the amplitude of H left is different than the amplitude of H right. What's interesting is that you have a black curve, a red curve, and a blue curve, and they correspond to different correlations in the polarization pattern of the CMB data. Okay? What's interesting in this picture is that if gravity waves left and right are different, you're to expect a larger signal, okay, for this guy compared to the others. Now, I was just talking to Bruce Partridge a week ago, who's one of the PIs of the Planck experiment. He and Wilkinson were the ones that measured the first anisotropy. He got very excited about this. All right, and he's, he builds this, one of the guys actually builds the satellites. Okay? Because you have a distinct way, if you were to go and measure these guys, and he's saying, I really believe Planck has a chance of measuring polarization. I really do. But maybe that's because I've been working on it for over 40 years. But this will actually be the smoking gun of something like this barrier genesis measurement. That's what's exciting about this. Now, what we need to do is actually take our theory and actually process the same thing here. But I expect we'll get a very similar thing, where the difference here will actually correspond to the number of lepton spins. All right, now let's move on to part three. So that's sort of like the basic upshot is that gravity waves are produced in a biased way. We call this thing birefringence or circular dichroism. The biologists use this as well. Snails like to, use light energy in a similar way. So the basic point is gravity waves bias, okay? Bias the production of leptons over anti-leptons. And while you would expect this thing to get diluted because of inflation, because the gravity waves are continually produced, it compensates for that dilution. And so you can actually cook up a leptogenesis mechanism in this manner, and you can cook up in many other ways, but this is just one way in which you can do it in terms of inflationary observables. So, I think I lost something. Yes. The upshot of this part of my talk is the following. That when we look at, again, perturbations of gravity in terms of the weak field limit, so that's how we test gravity in the solar system, right? We have to look at it in the so-called post-Newtonian framework, all right, where we get back Newton's law plus corrections or fourth order in the velocity of an object moving around the sun. Okay? And when we look at gravity in that regime, we perturb the metric of the solar system, for example. The important thing here is that there are a set of these ppm, these parameters, these potentials that are very similar. The simplest one is the so-called Green's function, their potential itself, the gravitational potential. Deviations from that is one of the ppm parameters, okay? The so-called gravitational potential. So the deflection of light behind the sun is actually used to constrain that parameter. Now, there are other ones that correspond to higher moments of velocity of, for example, an object moving around the sun. Okay? Some kind of test body, in this case, our Earth. It turns out what Chern-Simon does, it predicts a new one that was never looked for. And this is it, we're staring at it. V is actually corresponds to a vector, the vector part of a metric perturbation. And this induces a frame dragging that is normal to the vector part created by the source in the solar system, in this case, the sun. So this is a new PPM parameter. And our colleagues at Caltech spent some time looking at how to constrain this with the LAGEO satellite and gravity probe B. Might have you heard of something called the Lenz-Thurn effect? Okay. It's a frame dragging of the gyroscope, okay, as you go around some object that's spinning. So to do that, I want to introduce a framework that's very cute. So we all know that if a charged particle moves in the presence of a magnetic field, what happens? A constant magnetic field. So a magnetic field, it's pointing in the z direction up this way, and I have a charged particle moving in a straight line. Right, the right-hand rule, right? There's going to be a Lorentz force, a v cross b term. Okay? Good. What about if you have an electric particle moving in the presence of an electric field? It gets accelerated in the direction of the electric field. Good. Now, let's do the following thing. If I take a gravitational perturbation around our solar, some metric, in this case, let's assume it's flat, but this will work for the solar system as well. When I identify, I just rewrite H in this way. It turns out that the perturbed Einstein equation at first order and the geodesic equation, okay, which gives us back, F is equal to ma, end up all looking like this. So I want you to take all of your intuition of a charged particle, okay, except now the charge is mass. Now the magnetic field is the spin of the source, of the sun, and basically all of your intuition about the motion of charged particles in electric and magnetic field maps onto the geodesics of test bodies in the presence of, in this case, a rotating body like the sun. It works. It's called gravity-magnetism, and this is actually what people it's quite common in the community that tests general relativity in the solar system. So we're going to use this, and here's what's really cool. A test body gets accelerated because in this case, it's spinning. For example, if I take an object in general relativity, I write a stress energy tensor in a way that looks like a current. Here it goes. So it has some angular momentum J, right? Some energy density rho. Then basically, you can show that as this object rotates, there's going to be a poloidal motion, which is a motion in this direction due to the test body or precession, and a toroidal precession in this direction. Just like you would expect, okay, for a charged particle moving, it makes a particle tend to rotate. Okay? Does everyone see this picture? It's just all your intuition from the E&M maps into that of charged particles. Here's what's really cool. Chern-Simon's gravity does the following thing. General relativity predicts some magnetic field due to solving these equations in the presence of a spinning body, like our sun, or binary pulsar, which we're going to talk about next. But what Chern-Simon's gravity does, because of this new PPM parameter, it sources an extra term in a very unique way that you cannot repeat in other modified theories of gravity, period, because we tried it for years. So what does this really mean? It means that if I look at a spinning body, it has some angular momentum pointing this way, outside, and I have a test body going around it, you're going to change the precession along the lines of nodes. These are the lines that correspond to, if I have the moon and the earth, the reason why you have an eclipse is because the moon, basically, its orbit around the earth, right, is tilted on plus or minus 5 degrees. That's different from the plane of rotation between the earth and the sun. And when there's an intersection of the line of nodes, those two planes, you can get an eclipse. Well, a similar thing happens here because of transiting gravity. It leads to a prediction, a very specific one. So GR gives you this prediction, and this is the ellipticity that is this, and I'm not going to tell you what that is. And so the basic point is that is nothing more than a frame dragging effect. So curved black holes do the same thing. It just does it much stronger. Settle that already. And this is the basic result. What Chern-Simons predicts, generic, is that if you have a source, your distance to the difference between that precession and over what general relativity predicts, all right, that difference is proportional to how far you are from the source, okay, and the radius of the source. So this effect is very tiny in on Earth and in the solar system. But let me now talk about gravity waves, and I'll get back to what the observations say. So another way you can actually look at the effects of Chern-Simons gravity or parity violation. Again, this also applies whenever I have productions of gravity waves where the amplitudes are different. I'm just using Chern-Simons because it's a framework where I can actually calculate. Okay? The following thing happens. When I look at the gravity waves, this is in a different regime. This is not the slow velocity regime where in the Newtonian approximation, where the velocity is slow of the test body. Gravity waves are moving at the speed of light. So now I have e to the I kx minus omega t, which is just a complete phase information. So LIGO or LISA will actually detect that phase information by looking at the inclination of it. I'll show you a picture in the next slide. And also the amplitude. So it's going to be able to measure these two different things. And here's what's really cool, what Chern-Simons actually predicts. It modifies the dispersion because the amplitude gets modified. And so you're going to say, well, how do I measure this? How do I construct an observer once the dispersion relation of a gravity wave gets modified in this specific way? Again, it's not the frequency that gets modified, the amplitude that gets modified. And here's what you do. You actually look at the ratio of h left to h right, and you realize that it just factorizes into the ratio of the GR result plus this, what I'm now going to call a form factor, because we're using our intuition from particle physics. And if you, skip something. Good. And then the question is, how do you measure that? So now I have two things, two predictions, in two different contexts. One is the solar system, satellites going around the Earth going around the sun. That's one context. And the other one is the production of gravity waves. And I know I have two experiments out there that can potentially look for those effects and be able to detect this effect of parity violation. Okay? So that's kind of where we are right now. I'm sorry to be going so fast, but I realize that I chucked too much into this talk. Okay? Well, I started late, though.
Yeah, you got about 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah, but I started late.
That's it, you got to count. We'll be nice to you, but keep that.
All right, so let's go back now to the solar system test, which is the case of the post-Newtonian framework, okay? So what do we know? The first thing is, I see John shaking his head because he looks upset. Okay, man, I got my hot dog.
My hand is absolutely still.
Okay. So the first thing, if you really want to believe a theory of modified theory of general relativity, you better make sure to pass all the tests of the solar system. And I'm happy to report to you that my colleagues who know this stuff much better than me check all that. I'm just a humble cosmologist. And the LAGO satellite, these are two laser range satellites that go around the Earth, and they can relay the differences in their orbits. Actually, Kamenkowski and his students, Tristan Smith, And Eric Chuck, I forget how his first name, or her first name.
Adrian,
thank you. They did wonderful work, and they constrained, actually, the coupling, okay, was the first constraint by using real solar system tests, okay? It's a very weak constraint. It says that the mass of this thing, this has the mention of mass here, has to be greater than 10 to the minus 14 electron volts. Not a great thing, but, you know, it's a good start. But we can do better there. So Spergel and Nico Yunez at Princeton realized that, oh, wait a minute, we know from binary pulsars, we have two spinning neutron stars going around each other, their distance is 10 to the 4, okay, smaller than the distance between, say, Earth and between the satellite and Earth. And so now you can use that result. So, for example, in this, if you look at the altitude of the satellite compared to the rays of the Earth, you know, that's how we get F is equal to mg, right? Because we know, okay, so it's a tiny effect, and that's what they constrain. But for a binary pulsar, you get an enhancement of 10 to the 4 from the same, of the enhancement of, now this is a very important thing. I have a semi-major axis and a semi-minor axis of one neutron star going around the other guy. As it goes around, there's a precession of that orbit itself. What I mean by that is that that orbit tilts a little bit in this direction, and then it goes around. And then it tilts after it goes around another one. That precession is actually what Jeff uses. All right. And what they found was that they can constrain data to be very interestingly in the scale where we expect dark energy to show up. So they got somehow, Spergel got excited about this. You know, you can ask him why he was excited about it. So what about gravity waves? Well, very interestingly, one of the big testing grounds for gravity waves are some looking at objects called emeries, all right, which are mass ratio in spirals. So in other words, a solar mass object and a supermassive black hole, and the solar mass object basically in spirals into this thing. Okay, and you, people that do numerical relativity beat this system to a dead horse. And the LISA satellite is actually designed, part of it, to look for these things because LISA expects to see on the order of 100 of these things should LISA ever, like, you know, take off. Okay? So this is a good place. I mean, if you really want to look for gravity wave, this is the sweet spot. All right, and this corresponds to wavelengths of one cycle per 100 seconds. So if you do that, me and Sam Finn and Nico, we showed that when you look at, you can actually use LISA to look at this. And how does LISA do it? What LISA will look at is that if you look at an emery or two neutron stars, for example, again, there's a plane of rotation and an angular momentum perpendicular to that plane of rotation. And there's a so-called inclination angle that is subtended between the line of sight between Earth and the plane of rotation. That inclination angle is encoded in the phase information of the gravity waves. But what happens is that it goes away if you have left-handed and right-handed of equal amounts. But if left-handed is different from right-handed, the apparent, this factor here is basically amplitude different where we've done this in a complete treatment where we, you know, do the math correctly. You get a form factor and the so-called bimodal frequency of the gravity waves and times Hubble, depending on how far you are from the source, what redshift. And what you find is that you get the apparent inclination changes. So if you observe this thing in the optical, as pulsars give information also in the optical, right, they shoot off these jets. And then you get the information from the gravity waves, then you can compare those two things. If they're different, then you can constrain or detect gravity pattern violation. Does anyone see that picture? So what's there? There's a lot to be done here. and especially on the theory end, because all I did here was to motivate observational reasons why this is exciting. Point is, we have not tested priority violation in the strong or weak field limit of general relativity, because we never had this PPM parameter that encodes it. That's the point. Okay? And so we should not be biased. We should not be theoretically biased. The same way if we were theoretically biased that the weak force was priority violating, we'd be wrong, because nature tells us that's not true. Nature, right? Nature is a thing that has a final say. Much smarter than we are. Well, okay. Maybe some people are smarter than nature. So let me tell you a little bit about the program that's going on with people who really do hardcore numerical relativity, and they really know what they're doing. What they want to do is look at the full dynamical framework, find exact solution, because it turns out that the Kerr black hole is not an exact solution in this framework. So one way you can rule this theory out is to go and measure, look at a supermassive black hole, and prove observation that it is exactly a Kerr black hole. Okay? Because this Kerr black hole does not exist in the exact solution. But exact slowly rotating solutions were recently found. Okay, and here's a metric for it. So what these guys want to do, these are the guys at Princeton, mainly, and MIT, some people at MIT, are what they're looking at is to go through the whole program of what they do in numerical relativity. You first find this relevant background. You calculate the quadrupole formula of the gravity waves produced. Then you study how Emery's actually behave in this background. Okay? And then you study binary black hole merges with the full geometry. And then you see exactly what the full-blown signal should be. And you compare that to other, to GR and other modified theories that do not have this parity violating effect. So I forgot to write down conclusion up there, but I just want to conclude. I'm exactly on time. The first, the Tronsheim's gravity is an effective theory of quantum gravity, and I call it an effective theory of quantum gravity because it seems that in some form of all these incomplete theories of quantum gravity, it points to this parity violating extension to the Lorentz effective action of general relativity. That encodes gravitational parity violation. And actually, that parity violation shows up observationally for things that we haven't measured yet. And one of those things, you get frame dragging of gyroscopes, okay? We get gravitational waves that are distinct from gravity waves that are produced in other frameworks. There's a new PPM parameter, so on and so forth. You can cook up a nice leptogenesis mechanism in terms of CMB observables. And, you know, future work is using gravitational waves in the way I told you to constrain a dynamical framework. But I want to leave you with a sense of there's a lot to be done here. And there's a lot we don't understand. But, I hope that many of you can, write papers on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As Stefan, you don't know, but people know we start with questions from the Psi scholars. So if anybody.
Is there a simple sort of Hendrick reason that the parity solution is longer a solution in Jensen's gravity?
Yes, that's a good question. The reason why is that if you plug in the Kerr metric into our dual, I like to write this way, it's not zero. But the Pontryagin constraint tells you that this has to be zero in the non-dynamical framework. And the dynamical framework, because the scale of field has hair, it's hard to, those solutions become the energy density of those, the scale of field becomes infinite. Okay, in the fast rotating regime.
Okay. Next question? Right. Okay, let's open it up then. Questions, comments?
So, could you turn this around? Yeah. Dark energy
That's a damn good question. I didn't think about it.
Questions? Yes. Are there any constraints on the theta parameter from the solar system tests so far?
Yes, the best constraint, well, actually, a paper is coming out by Avi Loeb, where they actually found exact solutions of neutron stars. And those solutions actually do something really interesting with the neutron stars that he knows a lot about. And apparently, that ups the constraint of 10 to the minus theta inverse, which has dimensions of mass, has been greater than 10 to the, 10 to the 4 electron volts or something like this. Or 3. So they got an order of magnitude better constraint with neutron stars.
And how will it affect the leptogenesis ratio?
We would hope that it would be very tiny today, because the leptogenesis is happening back, 60 eV back in the past.
So this considers theta as dynamical?
Theta is dynamical, but in this framework, we want theta to be tiny, because, as you know, if theta is huge today, I'm going to see huge events of some lepton-producing events. That's a great question.
Yes?
On grounds of the size of curvature, you could also add in R double dual and times some function. That's perfectly allowed. Of course, that will not violate parity, but it does seem to me that in principle, since it's still a curvature squared term, it should be included at the same level.
It should be included, and it actually, and now, I know that there's the Euler class, but that's not R double dual, right? The Euler class is two.
R double dual without any integration is the Gaspinian variance, but if you multiply it by a scalar function, then it's no longer.
So some Chinese authors have considered Chern Simons plus that, okay? And it's very interesting, they get an amplification. So there's a back reaction of this onto the gravity waves, and you get even more amplification of the circular polarization. And some other.
But it means there's an extra ppm parameter, the gravity waves will change, like all this other stuff has to happen.
Yeah, well, the thing that's interesting is that the ppm parameter that showed up in Chern Simons is unless you have this parity violation, it's good. Right? Because it's a curl of the vector part.
Right. I understand that. There's a parity difference. Still, there will be some other ppm parameter that comes into play.
That's right. And then that needs to be looked into. But what we're looking at specifically is this particular ppm, because it's very. Mm-hmm. The observables that were constructed are something that these tests can actually go after.
Okay.
John? In physics, to get a parity violation, you need a gamma phi of somehow coming in.
Yeah.
Creeps in somewhere.
That's right. So the epsilon tensor is proportional to the gamma phi.
So
it's 1/6 factorial times products of the gamma matrices.
So my question is,
something like that.
Is Chern Simons a unique way to do this with gravity? Because I minimally couple Einstein with Hilbertian. Actual vector somehow.
Yeah. So I said at the beginning of my talk that I can always introduce sources, like for example a fermion source. But what I was talking about here is like a theory just purely in terms of curvature.
I could bring in an actual vector.
Yes, I totally agree with that.
But that would be a
scalar field. So those things are there, but Chern Simons gravity is something that only involves curvature.
So vacuum.
Yes, vacuum.
You have a scalar as well.
Well, there's a non-dynamical framework as well.
But the calculations, all the interesting behavior for the dynamical framework.
No. You have interesting. You still have the ppm parameter for non-dynamical.
No, but there, you have the theta dot, right?
That's right. But that's right. That's it. So the dynamical. And if you look at the Jakeep paper, this is something an embedding that is proportional to time, to some time-like embedding.
So that's the dynamical thing. That's. Right, theta is dynamic.
It's an external thing. There's no potential for it, and no kinetic term.
It's not a matter field.
No, it's not a matter field. It's just an embedding.
But so you say
because the way you get this R dual with this theta is that you embed, right? You embed the omega term.
But then it has
some vector field.
So you're saying you're breaking Lorentz invariance? Because if it's just a function of time, then...
Well, you break it globally. But general relativity does that too.
I'm saying theta must have a kinetic, must be dynamical if it's just a function of time. If it's a function of time. Well... We can discuss that later.
Yeah, so if you write a kinetic energy term, it's just zero for this embedded.
Until it's zero, but I'm saying that in order to have dynamics, you need a kinetic term, usually.
Well, on shell presumes that you have a field equation, mm-hmm. right? So it's just an embedding, literally. I mean, if you look at the Jakeev paper, they literally embed a three-dimensional Chern sandwich term into four dimensions.
If you introduce a kinetic
term. This is a so-called embedding coordinate.
If you introduce a kinetic term to theta, it becomes a magnetic field. But you don't want that.
Well, I mean,
John, that's a rhetorical comment.
Yeah.
Okay, Sheldon?
Yeah,
wouldn't you normally expect it to have a potential, actually? I mean, the form of the term looks like similar to the QCD axiom, so you might get
in the context of
gravitation and instantons, and you might expect theta to be an angular parameter with a
well, that's what I said. No, so that's right. So in the context of string theory, this is the universal axion. Okay, and there is a cosine potential plus some of the terms you break here.
Does that affect any of your models?
I didn't want to get into that ball game because it's there, and you're free to look into that.
Does it mean you can't choose any embedding you want? I mean.
Again, the way the community takes this is that if you go to Roman Jakeev and say, what's his theory? He says, it's my theory. It's this. It has nothing to do with string theory or loop quantum gravity. I've constructed this theory. It's well-defined by his rules. And right, well, if you want to now talk about string theory, it has a volume factor. These things are, in fact, the paper, Jim Gates and I wrote a paper, actually, where we actually did embed this in some supergravity framework, and we constrained our leptogenesis mechanism. In terms of the string length scale, we constrained the number density produced in terms of the length scale given G string, and we got 10 to the minus 31 centimeters.
Okay, any last questions coming?
We didn't suppose that.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Steph is here through Saturday. And